Welcome back to another week here at the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, and as always, we're joined by the amazing, the talented, the thankfully here, Francesca Fiorentini. How's it going, Francesca?
What?
I was really worried with all the tech problems we're having that your video was stuck.
What up, Twitch and Twitch only? How's it going, John? Oh, here we are again.
Wait, are we not live on YouTube? No, we're totally live on YouTube.
No, I just wanted to do this just for Twitch. Because somehow, like, I'm a gamer, yo. No, look, John, cases are climbing and I'm scared.
I know. We're going to talk about it. Oh, it's going to be exciting.
This is a news show, right? That's what we do.
Yeah, that's like the label we put on the YouTube videos, I guess. Like, do you have to be in a category? And we're not quite fashion. So, I mean, we do have nice t-shirts like this one, which is available at Shop TYT. And we did used to do a fashion segment on Think Tank. But anyway, yes. So, we've got news for you about the pandemic, about weddings and the people who speak at them. We have an amazing throwback to 1 year ago in the pandemic, a video that I think a lot of you will probably remember. Let's see, Lindsey Graham, is he Rambo or could he whoop up on Rambo? One of those two things is true, and a lot of other stuff. We got Satan's shoes, you know, as we always do on Mondays. Unfortunate news on the pandemic, and that is that after weeks of declines of cases and then a plateau, the average number of new COVID-19 cases saw a 7% increase from the past week, according to the CDC. The average of new virus-related hospitalizations also saw a slight increase from the previous week. It's not evenly distributed across the states. More than 24 states have seen more than a 10% increase in new cases compared to the previous week. So while we are very happy to report when the news is going in the right direction with COVID, we also need to keep it real. And when it goes in the wrong direction, as it is right now, we have to be clear about that too. Now, in addition to the overall number of cases going up, the B.1.1.7 variant, which was first spotted in the UK, has now been identified in 51 US jurisdictions. And it's believed that very soon that is going to be the dominant variant of the virus that is infecting people. It is easier to spread. It is apparently more lethal as well. And so after a whole bunch of good news, Francesca, the cases are starting to go up just a little bit once again.
We can't have anything nice in this country. This is just, I mean, this is what we're doing, where we think we're out of the woods and we're not. We're like, oh, I could light this fire while I'm here. And among all this dry brush, I'm gonna go hang out with all my friends. People are tired, I get that, but like, we cannot let up. And even if you're vaccinated, I think we need to behave like we're not vaccinated. We need to be wearing masks. I think gathering, yes, but like wear your mask, please, please. Because we know these vaccines are, you know, what is it, 75 to 80% effective. That's not to say that people won't still get COVID and could have lasting COVID effects, as so many hundreds of thousands of people around the world have gotten. Long COVID is no joke. There are lasting effects. I've read articles about, you know, some like mental health effects of long COVID in addition to physical effects. So it's so worrying. I like woke up and I saw the little line creeping up and I was like, no.
Don't do that.
I want to leave.
It's like a kitten perched on a table about to push something off the edge. Stop. But no, unfortunately, it is going up. Now, there has been good news, really fast to reiterate. Lots of states are going to meet or beat President Biden's call to have access to the vaccine for everyone by May 1st, including, by the way, California. I did not expect that we would, but in less than 2 weeks. No matter where you are in California, me here in LA, Francesca in San Francisco, you will be able to sign up for an appointment for the vaccine. So that's good. But that said, so far, less than 30% of the US population has received at least one dose, and only 15.5% of Americans are fully vaccinated. Now, that is weighted, obviously, towards those who were at the greatest risk of hospitalization or death from COVID. So even with the cases going up, we should hopefully not see hospitalizations and deaths rise as much as in past peaks. But we still have a long way to go to get everyone vaccinated. So bear that in mind when you're running, like when you're going around, you still have to be diligent. I was in a line at IKEA. There was one family not wearing the mask, and it's not over. It's not over. Like you gotta actually still wear
it. Damn, IKEA in a pandemic. You are testing fate, my friend.
It was they were keeping the reason there was a line was they were not letting a lot of people in. So it was pretty good. Plus, it's a big area. Like you're not really close to people. And I didn't lick as much stuff as I normally do.
Sure.
I think I was okay. One of the most controversial medical figures during the pandemic was probably Dr. Deborah Birx, because she was on the inside and we believe that she did some good work, but she also occasionally wouldn't call out Trump like during his bleach moments, and she said some things that really unfortunate about him early on. Now that he is gone, she is being more open about the process along the way, and she's receiving some support from people who generally are a little bit more trusted in this area. So we're gonna run through all of that, including first here some video. This is coming from CNN's Weekend Autopsy of the Pandemic and the failures to deal with it. So here she is talking about what she thinks could have been done to save lives and how many lives might have been able to have been saved.
Well, I look at it this way. The first time we have an excuse, there were about 100,000 deaths that came from that original surge. All of the rest of them, in my mind, could have been mitigated or decreased substantially.
Okay, so it's the sort of thing that obviously gets a lot of headlines. And look, her saying it does mean more than some random joker online. But I feel like we've been saying that, and it seems like the most obvious thing in the world, Francesca. A lot of lives could have been saved if we had done things.
Yeah, very brave stance, you know, a year later. Now that you're out of the administration and the eyes of the world aren't really on you. I mean, yeah, we've been saying this from jump, and yeah, Dr. Birx has been trying to save herself since, you know, she allowed so much BS to pass through her and was sort of tapped once again because of her fancy scarves and her elegance to be like the Trump whisperer. And so I've said this before, I don't envy her position, but you have a position, you have a responsibility, and your job isn't really to be the, you know, a groomer of the president. He's ungroomable, okay? Mm-hmm. That pony don't wanna get his tail brushed. He wants to just gallop around. You're gonna have to be the one to tell us the truth. 1 year later, we're getting it. I mean, to be honest with you, why stop here, right? What about a criminal case? What about actually holding people accountable? Deborah Birx, in some ways, is trying to walk back and distance herself as far away from this administration as possible, just in case we would ever do something like that under President Biden. I don't see it happening, but man, I think it should.
Yeah, I think one of the weirdest things about all of this is, like, first of all, basically as president, you can't go down for anything. But the things that in theory you could are always way smaller and more specific and less consequential than the things that you never could, you know? Like they got Nixon, but like but if Trump failed and 300,000 people died, he didn't have to. Well, that's politics in America. Maybe we'll get them next time. Isn't that weird?
Yep.
Isn't that weird? Like, I don't know, man. Like, if I, for instance, like if I was working the fries at McDonald's and I dropped a rat in there, I could, like, there's failures that you can get fired for in every other. I don't know why I had the rat.
No, yeah, nearby, but if all of the fries have a little bit of rat feces in them,
yeah,
and a bunch of people die from E. coli, yeah, you don't, you know, that's
it's
just
weird that, yeah. Anyway, he definitely, there's rat feces all over America.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. It's like we always waited for him to go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone, and he didn't quite do that, but I think he did one better when it comes to murder and taking lives with him and his ineptitude and his ego and like lies. So hey, hats off to the guy who we won't, I don't know if we'll ever have justice for the amount of lives. I know that I know there's a class action lawsuit waiting for sure.
Yeah, no, I don't think that we will. Birx in this interview talked about the politics of the White House, and let's see if we buy it.
Is your sentiment right now, are you upset? Are you frustrated, sad?
I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged that there's a team in the White House. It was very difficult being just one person in the White House. And I think people really didn't understand. I was the coordinator of the response. I wasn't the originator of all of the responses. HIV was what we call a symptom.
In March, when Dr. Birx was recalled from her post as global AIDS ambassador to join the task force, she had little experience working inside a White House and quickly realized that the role of the doctors was not going to be at all what she expected.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Good evening.
I underestimated the White House and the politics, but throughout these 11 months, Dr. Fauci and I probably talked or texted 5 out of 7 days every week.
So, sure. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. That whole thing, though, Francesca, didn't it feel a bit like a PR rep for Birx would have put together this with CNN? Obviously, that's not what happened, but it reads like that. It reads like wanting to protect her, defend her, remake her image after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely. But look, mainstream outlets love that. Oh my God, Birx is gonna write a book. You wanna write a book? Were you part of the administration? Did you like it? Did you hate it? How did you feel? Like, we are going to make a star out of you. Can you dance? Like, this is what mainstream news does. It's not about
sing with a mask on.
Yes, exactly. Sure. Just put the scarf over the face. You know, and sing for your penance. Like, this is what we do. We resuscitate people. I mean, interestingly, the only group of people we haven't fully resuscitated, although Jenna Bush is on NBC, is the Bush administration.
Although I would say, I don't know, all the stuff about him painting pictures of dogs and stuff, that kind of felt like a bit of a resuscitation of George Bush. I don't know. I'm not saying that like long term he's super acceptable, but I bet people's opinions of him have changed quite a bit. Anyway, we're gonna get Francesca back. I did want to continue though, because while we're still very skeptical, Dr. Birx does have a defender that generally people trust a little bit more in this area. So here is Dr. Fauci being asked about his working relationship with Deborah Birx.
You were working together. Did you have a strategy to do this? A good cop, bad cop?
I was the bad cop. She was the good cop. They referred to me, as I often say, as the skunk at the picnic. Because whenever they would say things were great, I would say, I don't really think so.
Should Americans be prepared for the likelihood that there will be 100,000 Americans who die from this virus?
The answer is yes. We need. It was easy for me to say that out loud and just openly say that because I had my base. My base was the NIH. But Deb had a much more difficult situation. She had an office right there in the West Wing. So I'm very, very reluctant to condemn anything that, even though there are people who feel that she should have pushed more, she probably should have. But boy, she did a lot of good. She knocked herself out, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, putting that data together, presenting it every day.
So I'm still, after the experience of last year, it's gonna be very difficult for me to really fundamentally change my view of her. I do, look, I'm not, you know, a Fauci sexual or whatever terminology they might use. I'm not like obsessive in my praise of people like this, but I do trust him more. And the fact that he's been willing to say things that potentially could get him in trouble in terms of his career is noteworthy and also more than we were seeing from Deborah Birx at the time. So look, his opinion does count for something, and him saying that she was working a lot counts for something. I don't know, it doesn't seem like the work ideally should have influenced Trump and his policy. Now, maybe that's an impossible task. Maybe there was nothing that could, you know, roll that boulder up the hill, I guess. But the fact that like she put together the information and then be presented to the American people, sure, that's good. But is that what people remember those press conferences for? When they were so often taken over by Donald Trump for his insanity, you talk about hydroxychloroquine and things like that. I don't know. I guess maybe there wasn't much she could do in that area, but I guess it counts for something. I just don't know how much.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Now, Dr. Birx does have to, I guess, address one of the worst early moments of her performance as an aide in this effort in the White House. And she does so in the CNN interview while talking about her overall strategy for dealing with politicians who don't necessarily trust science. Let's take a look.
If you knew anything about this White House, they kind of had an anti-science, or at least not a significant science-supported reputation. How did you plan on dealing with that?
You know, I've dealt with presidents and prime ministers around the globe who will often have misperceptions about diseases and the community that that disease impacts. But I've always found that if you can find that common ground with the information and data, they will change policies.
He's been so attentive to the scientific literature and the details and the data. And I think—
And it's part of the reason why I did say at one time, the president looked at the data and understood the data, because he wouldn't have shut down the country for 15 days and then another 30. But that never really happened again, because there were too many parallel streams of data.
Okay, and look, in the extended interview, which you can find, she goes into those parallel streams of data and they talk about where they're coming from, and they correctly identify, I think, that Scott Atlas was one of those, although they imply that there are others. I don't know, there's a certain amount of investigation into that that sort of seems at some point superfluous. Like, I don't necessarily believe that Trump changed his view because of Scott Atlas. He brought in Scott Atlas because Scott Atlas was saying the sorts of things that he wanted to hear on Fox News. I feel like the causality is weirdly being diagnosed going in the wrong direction there. I think he started looking for people like that because it was a convenient thing politically for him. The weight of the sort of ideological pressure was to reopen regardless of what happened. So let's get some people wearing suits to say that that's the right thing to do. I don't think it was that he was having these meetings with Birx and he was like, you know, I was checking your methodology and I really think that you're missing some things. I just don't think that that's what happened. I think her strategy in theory could work. It is not necessarily a terrible strategy to go in with most politicians who are vain, simple, and curious creatures and sort of flatter them and that sort of thing. And Trump is perhaps the clearest example of that. The thing is, if you do that publicly, like, it's one thing to do it in meetings with them to try to make them feel better about all this. But if you go out and one of the first things we see from you is you saying that Donald Trump of all people could be a doctor, that he's just absorbing all of this stuff. And then you leave that out there and he's in charge now and he's communicating about, you know, hydroxychloroquine and all that, then that's done some actual damage, I think. And you rolled the dice, I guess, and it didn't work out, and it's consequential. And look, there's a lot more. We don't have time to go into everything. She talks about how she feels like she was being censored. I guess maybe, but you still you're a public figure. Like, you can get on any one of these networks. If you feel like there is a message that they won't let you deliver at a White House press conference, but has to above all be delivered, you can do that. It's not really being censored. It's like not being boosted. But at a certain point, maybe a message being delivered is more important than you still being on the inside, especially if we're into August or September and it's clear that they're not listening to you anyway. I don't know. Fauci speaking out for means something, but a lot of it just feels like PR. It feels like PR way after the fact. It feels like a continued effort to be able to work your way back into the Biden administration, and probably for the right reasons, probably wanting to help. But that, it sort of reeks of that, and I just don't like it. We've been having a little bit of fun, I guess, remembering the last year of the pandemic by noting some of the anniversaries. And the anniversaries really of some of the most outrageous things that were said along the way that sort of set the tone for the pandemic. Got a special one for you today. It is Kenneth Copeland, and he wanted to just end this thing early on. 1 year ago today, we were supposed to be done with this pandemic, as you'll see.
Execute judgment on you, COVID-19. I execute judgment on you, Satan. You destroyer, you killer, you get out, you break your power, you get off this nation. I demand judgment on you. I demand a vaccination to come immediately.
Yes.
I call you done. I call you done, gone. You come down from your place of authority, destroyer. You come down and you crawl on your belly like God commanded you when he put his foot on your head in the Garden of Eden.
He sort of like ran out of in the Garden of Eden. Jesus. We have Francesca, right? Francesca,
oh, you able my to God. See that? I'm so sorry. Are we talking about devil worship?
Look, the people in the crowd don't think that that's what they're doing, but I think that's the closest thing to what it actually is. It's not original to point it out. Many people have. There is nobody on the planet who looks more like Satan cast in human flesh than Kenneth Copeland, which you would imagine would be like a roadblock to getting a job as a priest of some kind. That dude looks like he's got demons in his skull. I don't believe in any of them, but I start to when I look into his dead abyssal eyes.
He looks like the, I am so sorry for the internet problems, but he looks like the, who's the snake in the Jungle Book? Is it Shere Khan or the, or
Shere Khan's a tiger?
He looks like a Jungle Book character. It's not the snake, but it's he's scary. You know what I mean? Just like
the snake. I think you mean Shere Khan, actually. Maybe. It's not even a good performance. Like, he was stumbling over it. He can barely move, and he's got that really sad sidekick who's doing like a 1/10 energy version of what Kenneth Copeland is doing, because that guy doesn't have demons in his soul. So he's just like holding his hand out like, yeah, demand belly. I like the belly part. Do the belly thing. Oh, maybe it worked. Maybe immediate, like maybe this is as fast as God could do for the vaccinations. He said, I want it immediate. And God's like, how's a year? Maybe we got it because of Kenneth Copeland. Anyway,
I haven't had internet. So like for a brief, honestly, for like 4 minutes, I felt very calm and present.
Yeah, no, you're back into the breach once again. Anyway, the last thing I'll say is, look, there are a lot of good people who have honest religious beliefs in a number of different things. And every religion has its crazies and its extremists. But how does he have anyone in that room? Like, I get maybe he's wealthy, he builds the room, he stands there and he shouts, but it should be at empty chairs. Why is anyone sitting in that room and thinking, this guy's got a direct through line to God? The person who created the universe is channeling through this goblin in front of me. And sure, all of his predictions are wrong. None of them come true. But yeah, think, no, this is the guy I want to give money to.
You think Jesus was this obnoxious? You know, like Jesus didn't come down like, I swear to God, like he was not crazy. He was, you know, I mean, I feel like, you know, he was soft spoken, sandals, any guy in sandals, you know what I mean?
That's the way they present him, yes.
How were his toes? Maybe it's not honest, I don't know. I'm curious about the toenail. Did he have toenail hair? Was the toe, were the nails clipped nice?
For Kenneth Copeland? I think it's technically.
Oh no, Jesus. Oh no, I'm not talking about Jesus.
Nail, but anyway, yeah.
So Kenneth Copeland is just turning into a nail.
His whole body. Anyway, that was just a quick little look back at one of the steps along the way of the last year. There will be others and worse, but I happen to remember that one. The country is once again locked into a debate over doing something about guns. Spoiler alert, we won't. But Lindsey Graham wanted to get involved and make a case for why he felt he personally needed to have access to AR-15s.
What's wrong with a serious debate after all of these shootings about assault weapons and especially about large capacity magazines, which a lot of studies show contribute to these mass killings? Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong about debates. Matter of fact, I would challenge Senator Schumer to bring the assault weapons ban to the floor of the United States Senate. It won't get 50 votes, much less 60. I own an AR-15. If there's a natural disaster in South Carolina where the cops can't protect my neighborhood, my house will be the last one that the gang will come to because I can defend myself. You don't have to have an AR-15, but if you have one lawfully, I think you should be allowed to keep it. Most of these problems have a lot to do with mental health. Count me in for addressing that issue. Red flag laws exist in 19 states. There's some things we can do, but at the end of the day, if you think an assault weapons ban is what the country needs, bring it to the floor of the United States Senate and vote on it.
Yes, and look, for Jessica, he basically is saying, you know, bring it, it won't get 50 votes. You know, I hate him, he's terrible, but is he wrong there?
Lindsey Graham is so, he's so obviously partisan because in mixed in with his like, I'm gonna shoot the hurricane if there's a natural disaster and no one can take that from me. But I do believe in mental health background checks. But anyway, you're not gonna get it through. Boop-a-doo, I have no moral values. Like this, he is such a partisan puppet. It does, like there's somewhere deep in there is actually what he might think. And again, he's sort of like, you know, blurted it out. But yeah, he's just challenging us on the sheer vote numbers rather than the implications and the importance of getting some kind of assault weapons ban passed to save lives. He knows it'll save lives. And then he's just using, yeah, I look, first of all, Lindsey, honey, no one's coming to your house either to rescue you or like steal all your weird porcelain like kitty cats that you have. You know, you've got dolls. Nobody wants your doll collection. Nobody wants your gun. Nobody wants your Nazi memorabilia. No one's stealing anything from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's, depending on how you define doll, I have a lot of toys in my house. So let's not throw stones here, Francesco, okay? And I don't have an AR-15 to defend my Funkos. Anyway, yes, so there are so many levels that you could like prosecute this case on the actual substance of whether these changes, as Francesca points out, would actually help. What the American people actually want would be one thing. Just what your senators will vote for is such a, it's not that it's pointless, it has a point, it stops the legislation. It's devoid of anything beyond the raw exercise of political power. Now, we should acknowledge briefly that, look, Lindsey Graham is, at least in theory, better on this issue than most other Republican senators. He alluded to red flag laws. He has previously actually supported those. Who knows if in the end he would actually vote for them, but he's been talking about them for a couple of years. That would be helpful. A lot of Republicans will say, let's care about mental health or let's worry about the crazies, but they wouldn't pass any legislation that would ever take a gun away from anyone for any reason. They just don't think that that's right. He apparently is not one of those. But while we should give him credit for that, the thing about like when a wildfire comes, as someone noted in the Twitch chat, the fire's shooting at us. Yeah, like, no, that's not what you need. Stop. Like, I, as I always say, when they have their fantasies about militias and all of that, I have fantasies about like fighting orcs, but I don't try to legislate based on those fantasies. You can have your fantasies and have fun with it, but you don't set government policy based on the insane things that you imagine happening that will never actually happen. So as Robert Kelly pointed out on Twitter, he is setting out a scenario that we should legislate based on, which is that a natural disaster has happened. It's so bad that the police and the National Guard and the military can't help him. That's how bad it is. Gangs have taken over the streets, and that's what we should legislate based on. Not someone can get one of these guns and shoot up a Walmart. Things that actually happen. So we have the things that actually happen, and we have the things that the fantasy is. And also, isn't it weird that in his fantasy, he, a US senator, is holed up in his house rather than going and trying to solve the problem in some way? Like, he's not actually even trying to be a part of the solution. But more importantly, I would say, it really does betray a view of American society that really seems at odds with our actual experience. So he believes that, you know, when the going gets tough, that's it. You just have to start shooting. And he imagines, you know, gangs coming, and that's the threat. If he were to actually define what he imagines that threat looking like, it would get really, really bad really fast. But in practice, a lot of people have been through experiences like this, and it isn't actually that way. So in response to one of the videos of Lindsey Graham, Tim tweeted, I lived through a natural disaster in South Carolina. It was called Hurricane Hugo. For 10 days, there was no electricity, running water, or cops, no marauding gangs attack, only neighbors helping neighbors. The problem isn't disasters or gangs. The problem is you, Lindsey. Another person replied to that saying, I remember Hugo. We were in military housing. Neighbors shared food and water. Electricity was out for 2 weeks, so we actually talked instead of being glued to the TV. We were led around the commissary with flashlights. Friends drove to neighboring states for supplies. Now, you could, in theory, live and legislate based on an idea that we actually want to help each other. They pretend to believe that when it comes to their church and stuff like that, but they don't actually live, let alone legislate in that way. They're prepared for the worst in some things. In others, threats to your life like the pandemic, well, God will take care of it. But when it's a gang that's coming to your house, then God isn't good enough. Jesus ain't gonna save you. You need an AR-15, at least in their wildest fantasies. Before the gangs actually come, about a week out, you're gonna have some warning signs of the apocalypse, and it's intermittent internet connections. That's gonna be one of the things that's gonna let you know that bad stuff is coming. The saga of Sharon Osbourne has come to an end, or at least this chapter has. She's gonna be leaving CBS's daytime talk show, The Talk. After all of the stuff that happened in the wake of Piers Morgan and the Meghan Markle interview and all of that. To catch you up, earlier this month, she expressed her support on air for Piers Morgan after a critical commentary he made about Meghan's interview with Winfrey. She made it on air. She also tweeted saying, Piers Morgan, I'm with you. I stand by you. People forget that you're paid for your opinion and that you're just speaking your truth, which the concept of speaking your truth is annoying enough by itself. Don't deploy it in defense of Piers Morgan. He's not living, laughing, and loving. He's not on a culinary retreat to India. He just doesn't believe the black woman ever tells the truth. That's all it is. It's not speaking your truth. It's speaking your racism. That's all it is. Anyway, we have a bit of video from the talk, so let's run to that, and then we'll give you our thoughts.
I feel even like I'm about to be put in the electric chair because I have a friend who many people think is a racist, so that makes me a racist. And for me, at 68 years of age, to have to turn around and say, I ain't racist. Right. What's it got to do with me? Okay, how can I be racist about anybody? How can I be racist about anybody or anything in my life? How can I?
We'll be right back. What? We have more topics, so don't go away.
And I think we should stop this.
Okay, I apologize. I don't know any of their names, but that woman at the end was totally, whether intentionally or not, trying to save Sharon Osbourne from herself by cutting to that commercial, because that was not good. That is a breakdown, basically, that Sharon Osbourne just had. Anyway, so look, the fact that they're moving on from Sharon Osbourne, look, people are gonna have an issue with it. They had an issue with Piers Morgan. Is it just because she defended Piers Morgan? That's how they might try to pitch it. I honestly, it feels like at this point, based on the, again, not that I super dwelled in the weeds on this, I feel like she really went more into it on a personal level than Piers Morgan did. Piers Morgan tried to start some sort of feud with Meghan Markle, I guess. Sharon Osbourne was really talking about herself there. And if you've had questions about Sharon Osbourne's views or thoughts on race or how it might have intersected with some of the other people that had worked there, I think this really re-raised those things. So we have a tweet from Holly Robinson Pete who says, I'm old enough to remember when Sharon complained that I was too ghetto for the talk, then I was gone. I bring this up now because I was mortified watching the disrespectful, condescending tone she took with your co-hosts who remained calm and respectful because she had to. Yeah, and so this, it doesn't seem like this is the first time, and it seems like it is not just a personal thing. I think people could have an issue with it if it was just a personal thing. But if it has led to conflicts that have ended jobs for people, and that was being influenced by her own personal racist views, that's a big issue then. That may not be what most take away from this. Certainly her defenders are probably not gonna stress that sort of thing. We have a message from her spokesperson. It says Sharon is disappointed but unfazed and hardly surprised by the lies, the recasting of history and the bitterness coming out of this moment. She will survive this as she always has, and her heart will remain open and good because she refuses to let others take her down. So if you feel that this was not a thing where she was going to really be open to learning and evolving, they're doubling down on that, Francesca.
I don't know if my connection is good. Once again, Mercury must be in a million retrogrades. I apologize if I am a pixelated monster, but at least I'm not like a angry boomer, like white lady who's had many things given to her throughout her entire media career by being the wife of a famous rock star and then freaking out on national television in the year 2021 about potentially being racist. I'm not racist. Am I? Tell me to my face. Tell me. I just like, there's so much fragility. And like, if you need a lesson in white fragility, watch that clip again, because it's so painful that people aren't able to even interrogate their own belief system. They're not able to like sit down and like be humble, you know what I mean? As Kendrick Lamar said, and Sharon Osbourne, of course, when you inflate these characters, when you inflate people like Piers Morgan, you can't be humble because her entire career has been devoted to you, you know, not being and having great internet, you know, and like that I don't have.
You don't, not nearly, she's probably got fiber, but anyway. Yeah, no, it's a great point. Look, how could I, a 60-year-old white woman, be racist? I just don't get it. Yeah, you can. Yeah, how could I, let's say 32-year-old white man, how could I be racist? Yes, I totally could. That's how that works. You try to both believe and say and do the right thing. But like, if you don't have that history, which she really doesn't, and the things you're saying are exactly what racist people say, then yes. Yeah, that's probably gonna hurt you. That's gonna hurt you in this particular time. And you know, I don't know exactly where they're gonna go from here with this. CBS says, going forward, we are identifying plans to enhance the producing staff and producing procedures to better serve the hosts, the production, and ultimately our viewers. I don't know what any of that means or what any of that has to do with what we just saw. It's not like what Sharon Osbourne was lacking was the correct procedure. But anyway, yes, Francesca, your quality is totally worth it. And we can still hear you, your audio is very good. So I think that's the end of this. We'll see, maybe she'll be a correspondent on Fox News soon, I don't know.
Yeah, no, she will be. And I just wanna say like last thing, like it is hard to hear that you might be, you know, you might be racist or have said something insensitive. It is really difficult. But once again, exhibit A of how not to respond. And the more that we have systems in place, the more that we stop propping up people who are problematic, the more that we can name something without, and no one's talking about canceling, but again, calling in versus calling out folks, right? This is not about sending folks to the dustbin of history. This is about calling on them to be better. This is, you know, and so if she has a history and a pattern of saying racially insensitive things, and by the way, you heard her say, I ain't racist. Like, please don't, just don't say I ain't, like, don't,
yeah. Or
just don't. Ugh. You're a white lady, stop it. Stop, don't use that inflection or vernacular that you know, to deny your racism. It's so painful. So just to say, but it is on all of us, even if obviously, even if you're not white, you know, I'm Asian. I think all I think we all have our blind spots. We all have room to grow. And like seeing Sharon Osbourne's knee jerk reaction is like, oh God, like we all have that little part of us that's like, I'm not racist. You know, like how can we, you know, calm that down and do better?
Yeah. Yeah, you're 100% right. We all have blind spots. The worst one to have is a blind spot about your blind spots, to believe that you can't have them. And she clearly thinks that she is somehow, she has a little bit of that the Bill Maher thing. I've already proved myself. Get off my back. What are you talking about? Me racist? No, I'm too cool for that. It's impossible. How could I, an 80-year-old white man, be racist? Well, apparently you found a way. Damn it, they found a way.
102, John, 102, yes. Don't be.
We were in an unprecedented time for the Republicans, for conservatives across America. They were now, according to them, the cool ones who were like open with about everything. And you libs just want to stop stuff and you don't want people to say things. We're cool, we like free speech. We're just open like that. Oh my God, someone made a shoe? And the whole thing came crumbling down. Because Lil Nas X, who we talk about constantly on this show, came out with a pair of Satan shoes featuring a bronze pentagram, an inverted cross, and a drop of real human blood. So these shoes came out and every Republican has lost it over some sneakers. So the governor, Kristi Noem said this, our kids are being exclusive. But do you know what's more exclusive? Their God-given eternal soul. Pump the brakes, Governor. Pump the Dakotan brakes. We're in a fight for the soul of our nation. We need to fight hard. We need to fight smart. We have to win. And we need to put the right things on our feetsies. Okay, she didn't say the last part, but wow. They're exclusive, you nincompoop. Because they're only making 666 pairs, okay, which are now sold out, shockingly. Francesca, what do you think?
The far right is just mad. Like the real Nazis are mad they didn't come out with a blood drop shoe before that, because that sounds like something they would be super into.
Yep.
If it Aryan didn't blood. Come out from a exactly, oh, full of Aryan blood, perfect, exactly. Candace Owens first in line. No, it is. It's actually kind of quaint and also very telling that we're back to this like satanic panic, conservative Christian right, you know, Harry Potter's a devil, like that kind of, sorry, I have to do the Sharon Osbourne still, but like that kind of like mania, because it feels like maybe there's larger consensus about the big stuff, about climate change, about healthcare, about, you know, like racial inequities and policing, the need for policing reform, you know, the right to an abortion, all the main things, massive inequality, all the important stuff is being ignored. They got to focus on blood drop shoe. And so there's that, there's a little bit of, oh, that's cute. You're trying to like bring this back. It's so old school of you.
It is. It's look, I think you're, so they're predisposed to do it. They love this stuff. They love like, it seemed interesting to be like the cool hip ones, but then they're like, oh no, wait, getting worked up over Satan. That's better. But then also you add the layer of Q, which has gotten people re-obsessed with Satan. So I think that being able to attack him is like a way to like wink, wink at the Q people without being explicit about it. Right. But anyway, so they've lost it. We're gonna have some video. In response, Lil Nas X posted a video to his official YouTube account titled Lil Nas X Apologizes for Satan's Shoe, which has now been viewed over 1.8 million times, probably far more than that by now. But after a few seconds, the apparent apology cuts to a scene from his new music video, Montero, showing him dancing provocatively with a devil character. The rapper is then pictured snapping the devil's neck before removing his horned crown and assuming himself. So I don't get what the problem is. Killed Satan.
Killed Satan.
Isn't that what you want? He killed him. Isn't that the good thing?
First of all, the music video slaps. The music video is amazing. Yeah. The song slaps. The song, because sometimes you don't know. It's like, oh, is the song gonna be good? I love Lil Nas X's first album. It is so good. And then the music video is it's what Madonna was doing in the 80s, right? It's like,
well, they hated that.
A black angel. Yes, they hated that. And Lil Nas X is gay. And the song is like, call me by your name. Call me in the middle of the night. Like, let's do this. It is a gay black man embracing his sexuality. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very good. The song is good. The message is good. It's all just throwing everything. I'm surprised he wasn't drinking out of like a paper straw during and like eating vegan during the whole time. It's everything that scares the right. And I love it.
Fox and Friends was not going to allow the Satan shoes thing to pass them by. They had to weigh in, and they're not going to let something like the facts get in the way. So take a look in real time at how the misinformation happens on Fox and Friends.
And singer Lil Nas X causes uproar over shoes that contain a drop of real human blood. The so-called Satan shoes are to promote his newly released music video. Each shoe features a Bible scripture, an upside down cross. 666 pairs will be available starting tomorrow, with one pair costing more than $1,000. And those are your headlines.
What?
Drop of blood.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want that in my shoe.
You know who makes them?
Who?
Nike. Nike. That's not. It's a Nike shoe with the sign of Satan on the top, called Satan shoes.
Get out of here. There's got to be more.
I saw it before the show. So yeah. You can't have the Betsy Ross flag.
Yeah.
Come on,
man. You can have
man.
Nike-made Satan shoes. It's a real thing.
Will's in disbelief. He's like, I'm.
Didn't we
pumped.
Talk about this? I feel like I'm missing a piece of information. This game.
You're not. Because you know how many of them there are being made? How many of the shoes are being made?
She said 650.
666.
Oh, of course.
Of course.
You got to be kidding me.
I'm not kidding.
It's a little weird.
Look it up.
It's a little odd.
When up is down and down is up. And that's exactly where we are as a culture.
Something's.
It's really unbelievable.
Let's ask Adam. Adam, would you buy those shoes just out of curiosity? Maybe someone would like them. I don't know.
Could he say yes now?
I was gonna dodge this. They're not really Nike. They're Nike shoes, but there's a middleman who bought Nike shoes and is turning them into these.
Is that
really?
Nike's not making these shoes.
So it's like
I'm positive about that.
But yeah. Nike probably could sue them if he wanted for using.
There's
their
the missing information.
Image.
Thank you for that.
Oh, so I was dead wrong. Wait, but Nike could sue them, and if they don't, then they're condoning it. No, people can do stuff on shoes if they want to, and then they can sell it. That's. Anyway, yeah, up is down. This is where we're at in our culture, says the guy who's conveniently believing whatever fits into his worldview and then straining to not learn anything when that as a way to operate is shown to be false.
Thanks, weatherman, for doing our fact checking.
Yes, exactly, in real time.
And so what else do you, hey, is climate change real? Oh, no, still fake, still very much fake. But the shoes are, yes.
Again, like I said, it's the, we're cool and edgy. We're like the dark web. Oh, they made 666. How dare they? Because numbers have some sort of metaphysical meaning. Who cares? It's a stupid number. It doesn't mean anything. None of this means anything. Here's the thing about the Satan shoes. There's no Satan. Satan doesn't exist. He's a fictional character. Like Hagrid, somebody wrote about him in a book and that's it. He doesn't exist. And even if he did, he doesn't care about your feet or what you put on them. And if he is focused on that, then I don't think he's that big of a threat, honestly, Francesca. But that's the thing, at the end of the day, these people really believe in biblical fairy tales. That is, you cannot get farther from cool and edgy than I believe the thing a person wrote 2000 years ago as totally true. All of it's true, the mark of the beast, the horns, the numbers, it's all true. And oh, by the way, they shouldn't be allowed to sell these, because that was what was running through all of that. He was mad at Nike. He didn't want Nike to sell the shoes. Now he's not going to say, let's cancel Nike, but that's what he means.
Sounds like he wants them canceled. No, you're exactly right. You opened the segment saying exactly what needs to be said, is that the right has no claim to the idea that like, they're the party of free speech and people just want to live and do what they, no. White people rich, white, mostly men have a right, straight men have a right to do whatever they want. If you're within that certain Venn diagram, if you check three out of the four of their boxes, then you have a right to do whatever you want to do. Usually that means causing harm, insulting, berating, belittling, taking away the voting rights of a minority group, people of color. And that's a-okay, right? But yes, it has nothing to do with real free speech. Just like in our previous segment, you know, Lindsey Graham's gun laws, it's like, yeah. And like, so are you gonna go resuscitate the Black Panther Party? Do you still think that that was cool? Because the FBI sure didn't. And I feel like you were on their side on that one, even though they were proving that point. So we can't forget this, especially on the internet where it's like we're constantly fed, oh, see, you know what, the cancel culture, oh. Again, exhibit, I don't know how many we're up to now. 3,000 something, probably more like in the millions. But here you go, Lil Nas X and this stupid freak out.
Totally. And you know, they're not gonna listen to us or whatever, but you know, I would hope if you see someone who might not identify as hard right, Fox and Friend, whatever, that is advancing this idea that cancel culture or political correctness is this thing and it's just the left that does it. It's not true. It's never been true. It is a very convenient ruse to play on the American people to imply that one side's open to everything and let's all be cool and kumbaya, and the others are a bunch of Nazis that are trying to cancel everything. As I've always said, everybody doesn't like some things. Everybody doesn't like to hear certain things. If you want to test the commitment to saying politically incorrect things on the right, start talking about Christianity. And let's see how much they like you pushing the boundaries of political speech. They never have, they never will. Donald Trump popped up over the weekend, not like in public or whatever, but at a wedding at Mar-a-Lago, whether he was asked or not is not clear, but he just started talking to them and he did a bit of a wedding toast and it looked like this.
So it's a rough thing and I just say, do you miss me yet? As we were saying, we did get 75 million votes. Nobody's ever gotten that. They said, get 66 million votes, sir, and the election's over. Well, I got 75 million and they said, but you know, you saw what happened. 10:30 in the evening, all of a sudden they said, that's a strange thing. Why are they closing up certain places? But you know, a lot of things happening right now.
So sad for he's still talking about. Hey, random people, listen to, hey, did you hear what happened at 10:30? There was big dumps. All I have left is big dumps. Anyway, that was someone's wedding. There was a bride and groom sitting off camera. This is memories they're gonna have for the rest of their life.
He does not know that couple, I bet you anything. He has no idea who they are.
Yeah, no, look, apparently the guy was like a donor for a while or whatever, but no, I don't think that they know each other. What I will say though is, well, obviously this is not what a rational person would want as their wedding toast. It doesn't make any sense. It's not even about the couple for the most part. It's just him complaining and saying nobody's ever gotten 75 million votes, which by the way, he didn't get 75 million, he got 74 million. The guy who did get 75 million got more than 80 million, that was Joe Biden. He always leaves that part out. That said, I will predict that this is exactly what that couple wanted. It's not like you don't have your wedding at Mar-a-Lago and then feel inconvenienced when Donald Trump turtles his way onto the dance floor. You did it there because you like Trump against all odds. They probably believe that he actually won. They probably loved that he showed up at that thing to then stand with the weirdest posture ever. Like really, look at that video. I don't understand how his body functions. But anyway, there was a little bit more from the video that I wanted to focus on, mainly because you can see in real time the attempt to shift the Republican narrative around the border. So here is Donald Trump in more of that wedding toast.
The border's not good. The border is the worst anybody's ever seen it. And what you see now, multiply it times 10, Jim. You would know how to handle. He's the only one I know that might handle the border tougher than me. We have to, and the tough is in the most humanitarian way, because that's what it is. What's happening to the kids, they're living in squalor. They are living like nobody has ever seen anybody. There's never been anything like what's, and you're gonna have hundreds, and you have it now.
Okay, so yeah, nobody would be tougher. Nobody, but the tough would be humane, right? Because now we're the ones who care about the kids, because we're not in power. Yeah, we have to do it because nobody's seen it. You know, there's apparently like the numbers go up this time of year every year. That's what happens. But and nobody's seen, like, we've been critical of the facilities that the kids are being holding in. Nobody's seen them. You saw them. You set up those same, in some cases, the exact same facilities. So to imply that like nobody's ever seen any of this, no, but you want that. That was Stephen Miller's wet dream, was the establishment of these tent camps and the kids in cages. He wanted to see tiny little faces through chain link fences. That's how his marriage is able to continue. And so yeah, like they're trying to cover for it. They want to pretend again that now that they're out of power, it's Biden who's being needlessly cruel. And so anyway, I just thought that was an interesting little note. Hello and welcome to the weekly top 10 list with me and a pixelated version of my buddy Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
Good. I hope I don't look like Flappy Bird.
No, you actually look, it seems very strong. If you're watching this like weeks from now, we were having connection problems today. But anyway, we've got a fun top 10 list for you. And thank you to everybody for being tier 2 and tier 3 members on YouTube and getting access to these. We got a whole back catalog and we take requests. So let us know what list you'd like to see in the comments below. Today, it is the top 10 worst things about the pandemic ending and the world going back to normal. I assume, Francesca, it goes without saying that there are good things about that happening, but we're going to be focusing on the bad thing.
I think it's real. It's very real that a lot of us are concerned about, like, oh man, the timeout is done. Now time in. Yeah. What are we doing?
Exactly. So I sometimes I pick these as a way to like learn a little bit about Francesca. I think this might be one of those. And so why don't we jump into that? What's your number five?
You haven't learned enough, John. He wants more. Okay, number five is handshakes. I don't specifically. I'm not sure how greetings should be. In the very beginning of the pandemic, I think I was on the show and I said we need to bring the bow to the West. I believe we should just bow. It's a sign of, you know, I respect you enough to not get germs on you. And I don't think people wash their hands. Correction, I don't think men wash their hands. And I don't trust you enough to touch my hand. And like, you got a weird hand anyway. It's clammy, it's dry. It's too hard. It's too soft. You know, the soft, you know, I hate the soft handshake people. The point is I don't want to do handshakes.
Like a dead fish.
Yeah. Or it's like you do the work.
Yeah.
Like,
or like you go in and they kind of like either don't, they like, they stop advancing. So you grab like not enough. I'm like, no, but you do the rest of it. What are you doing?
No, yeah, I give you're a good right. handshake. I give a good, I would rather a hug, to be totally honest with you. And I'm not sure that would be more or less like a distant hug. We do like a little like a side hug. Bow, you know? Yeah. But then you get that like elbow hug or like shoulder hug where someone just like knocks you with the shoulder.
What do you think about salutes? Or like a fist on the chest.
Two militaries. No. I like the fist. Yeah. I don't mind the elbow bump. It is a little weird, but yeah, I just don't trust people. I don't think people are actually washing their hands. I think they say they are. I don't think they are.
I won't confirm or deny. My number five is going to be slightly different. It's going to be, you know, like I'm back at work now, but for a long time and still more so, I'm more at home than I was. That's like the big thing about the pandemic is that you are at home.
Yes.
And so that has strained some relationships, broken some relationships. For me, I feel like it's deepened my relationship. So, you know, obviously like with my wife, but we already loved each other. My dog and I are way closer than we once were. Like, no, really, he used to really prefer my wife to me. Now he only mostly prefers my wife to me. He likes cuddling with me in a way that he didn't used to. He's more eager when he comes out to greet me when I come home. Like, he's just more into me than he has been for a long time. And hopefully, you know, dogs are simple creatures. They'll just continue that way. But if that does weaken, oh, that would kill me. Cause like, I want my dog to be as into me as I am into him. And I feel like we're finally not on parity. I still like him way more, but like it's closer, and I don't want to lose that.
Aw, man, dog love. That's adorable. Oh yeah, my cat is like she's so codependent, but I also know like when I leave for 3 days or a few days, I like think of her all the time and like think of how she's doing and if the cat sitter is like doing okay. And then I come back, she's like, meh.
Yeah.
She didn't miss me.
She's happy on the inside.
At all.
Yeah.
As long as there was food.
Yeah. What's your number four?
Okay, number four is like spending money eating out. I just did my taxes and I was like, oh wow, I saved thousands of dollars not eating out. Oh. Like just not eating in restaurants, not eating. God, you know, I was a big sort of like order on caviar person, and then my like so I had some credit card issue with it because like damn, there's a scam going on there, not just the prices generally. But just cooking more, and like I started cooking a lot, and I like cooking. It's way healthier. It's way cheaper. We've talked about this before, and I'm like, ooh, I don't know if I have the jobs coming in enough to like support my habit of eating out. And drinking, I'm fine, by the way. I've been drinking a lot in quarantine, but when I'm determined that like I'm not gonna drink as much because it just burns a hole in your pocket. When I go out, I'll eat, but I'm not gonna like skip the $14 cocktails. But yeah, I'm just sort of worried about like the amount of money that's gonna cost.
Wow, man, you eat enough that you're making career decisions based on it. That is something.
I'm a freelancer, bitch. That's
true. Yes. My number four is actually about saving money. That's not why it's there, but it would save money. So one of the big things about the pandemic ending is, hey, you can travel again. And I don't want to. I like that I can't travel. I like that I have an excuse to not travel. It's not that there's nowhere I want to travel or occasionally, but I don't want to mostly go places. It's a huge pain in the neck. It's often not worth it. I think that you pretend it is. I like traveling sometimes, but not mostly. I like staying where I'm at. I'm here because this is where I want to be. And all of the things I like are here. So I mostly want to stay here. And leaving is not only a pain in the neck, it's also really expensive. So yeah, that's not going to be convenient once that excuse goes away.
I have like six now, but I will just say my number, what are we on? Four?
Three
is similar to that. Like the amount of burning of fossil fuels, I'm really not looking forward to the cheap airline tickets, the people just traveling all the time because they can. And there's been a lot of, you know, things written up about how especially business travel, which takes up a huge majority of the travel, like, you know, a vast majority is business travel, that it doesn't need to be, that people can just meet on Zoom. It's okay, you know, and they can stay put and there's no need to go these places. So that is, I'm worried though that like because we don't have a Green New Deal and because we haven't paid, you know, employees to like do other jobs than work in the airline industry. And we haven't like worked out a way where Boeing can become, I don't know, just a, like a old succulent gardens inside of their, you know, hollowed out fuselages. Like we are not at the point where we can really stop climate change and we cannot afford for people to be traveling this much. And so I'm scared. That's not what I'm looking forward to after the pandemic is over. Everyone needs to be more like John Iadarola.
Thank you. No one go anywhere or aspire to. My number three is actually in that vein, but even more locally. And this is the one that I think most people might have on their list.
Sure.
Parties and going back to parties. Not everyone. I like going I don't want to. There's certain types of parties and gatherings that I do want. Hell, I throw a good number of certain sorts of parties and gatherings. I like going to those sorts of things. I mean, just random like networking parties or like places where you're supposed to go and like worry about whether you matter enough. And like you have to like talk about your projects to people and they don't care because they just want to be talking about their projects. I don't want any of that stuff again. It's been a nice year of none of that BS. Anyway, what do you think? Are you excited to get back out there?
You don't want to get. you don't want to get name dropped on all over the place. Yes, in my work. No, I'm looking forward to doing live stand-up comedy much more. So that is sort of my networking. So that's fun. That's good stuff. But I hear you. Like unnecessary, like boring corporate parties. But free food and drink, dude.
Do like that. I do like food. Yeah. What's your number two? Actually, that's going to play into my number two. What's your number two?
Okay, number two, I've got to make sure that number two is traffic. I was sorry that my internet was so bad, but I live pretty far from the TYT studio. I do want to be there, but it takes me a pretty good hour to get over there. One time I tried to do my makeup in the car on the way over. I was pretty good at the red lights, you know. I was like boo, 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 ba, boo, ba, boo. But like traffic is such a drag, and it's such a drag in LA, and it's coming back, and it's just so much traffic. So I'm sure many people have this. I don't miss the traffic. I don't want it back.
The solution is simple. Move to Culver City. Duh. Move to Culver City. Yeah, no, that's going to be really annoying. And like, I want you back in the studio, but now I am going to feel a little bit weird about having people come into the studio. I used to, even before the pandemic, by the way, sometimes, like most of our interviews were remote even then.
Yeah.
And sometimes people would come in, and I always felt like that doesn't seem worth it. Like, you came all the way out here for like a 6 or 8 minute interview. All that driving, there's the emissions, the inconvenience. Ugh. You've like, when you park, gather up everything that you take out of your car, which is like the thing about living that I hate the most, is having to pick up 3 or 4 things as I get out of my car. I don't want that.
You need a purse. You need a man bag, obviously.
No, then I'd pick up the purse. That would be one thing. Like, there's no solutions. I've consoled myself for that.
You just want to be a man in the wild living, just swinging your arms low to the ground, just like, picking food off of trees.
Just take a bite and throw it away. Don't even carry it. Exactly. Yeah, some guys do like the everyday carry of all the things that they carry. I don't want more things. I already have keys. That's enough. I have glasses now. I have my mask. I have a water bottle. I have my bag. It's like 30 different things or 5. I don't know, but it's a lot. And yes, my life is very tough. Okay. Top 10 things that are tough about being me. Anyway, my number two is going to be, so I've seen a couple people from work at the studio. Tim Frisch was in once, Mary was in once. But for the most part, I haven't seen most people at the studio for some time. Mm-hmm. And at some point, we're going to. And then there's going to be that thing of, yep, so this is what I've done to myself. I don't want those moments. I mostly exist from here to here, but I don't want to like, yep, not only did I waste that year's potential, I backslid. So that's fun. I don't want to not be able to hide what I've done to myself anymore. I'm worried about that.
Are you like one step away from doing the full Homer Simpson moo-moo situation? Just like
basically, I test all my food by rubbing it on a wall to see if it becomes clear.
Right. I was going to say that being alone in the studio, like you don't have like privacy, like you can't take your number twos completely alone. Like that is what I would miss. Like being in any workplace, you having the bathroom all to yourself.
With a lot of additional people. Yeah, that's a pretty big. I hadn't thought. Maybe that'll be my number one now. Anyway, is that your number two?
No, we're at my number one.
Number two. Oh yeah, what's your number one?
Right, that's what I thought. I think I did the math right. Okay, number one is going back to the rat race. I do not want to go back to the clawing, the careerism, the what are you doing, the who are you, the what have you done, the da 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 da, and just like it's endless. You know, I think in a lot of people's fields, you know, you're like always trying to climb and do the next thing and get this job. And we're back to the rat race, and safe to say we've all been like Monopoly pieces set back. We've passed go backwards, no matter where you are. I think a lot of people feel that way, and especially in when it comes to like either comedy or just being a correspondent, being a media figure, it's difficult. And so like I'm not looking forward to going back to that, like, oh man, now it's my career, you know, and going back out there. It's going to be hard for a lot of folks.
So you want to perform again because you like the experience, but that experience set into the construct of career and networking and all that, that does
sound. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot. First of all, you have to get booked on, getting booked on shows is hard, right? I mean, it's a whole thing. I think I'm good, but there's that. You have to get booked. And this is in any field, right? This is musicians getting gigs. This is, you know, a stand-up comics. Yeah. This is freelance writers. This is just, again, the clawing. And it's very clear that there's less money in media now than there was before the pandemic. There's less money in a lot of places. So, you know, people are turning to things like Patreon, patreon.com/bituationroom. They're turning to, you know, it's like, it's difficult. So yeah, that I think is tough. And until UBI allows me to just sit in home and chill.
And not work. That's the master plan. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, well, joke's on you because studies show that it actually leads to more productivity and stuff. So you're gonna work harder.
True.
You're gonna be, it's gonna be the rich rat race.
It's anyway. So stupid because if I had more free time, I would just do my podcast more. Like I would just do more work, daily. And so would you.
Maybe play more video games too. But yeah, no, that's a good one. I think a lot of people can see themselves in that. My number one is, it's sort of vague. It's that over the last year, it's kind of freeing.
Yes.
Like. The terrible stuff is happening, and obviously, you know, all of this is assuming that you didn't get furloughed for a year, your job didn't disappear, you didn't, you know, like get sick yourself. Like, but if you were able to like pass that thing, like everybody sort of gets that we're in this together, except for, you know, half the country that won't wear a mask or whatever. But like we're sort of together and we're all going through something. So we can all kind of use that. Like if you do something weird, it's the pandemic. Like why did I buy a typewriter? It helped a bit kind of like for the pandemic. Yeah. So I bought one. Or like if you don't want to exercise, it's the pandemic. You know, you're freed up for that. You can eat what you can drink. Clearly that was my number two. Like if you want to, if like you need to take up a new hobby or something to sort of just help, like,
yeah, you have the mental space, the mental and physical space to kind of do it.
Yeah, and this is stuff that we should always be focused on wellness or whatever. But I feel like this sort of made it more socially acceptable, a lot of these behaviors.
Yes.
And maybe that's going away. And now it's like, you know, like the version of this that everybody gives is, I didn't want to wear pants anymore. And so I don't. But now maybe you have to. Maybe you can't just wear sweats all the time. Like there's everybody has their sweats, and we're about to lose our sweats. I think
I don't want that. Pants are a prison. Also, I don't fit them anymore. So we all need to wear muumuus. We need to aspire to be Homer Simpson coming out of this. Muumuus for everyone. That is socially acceptable.
Exactly. That's my fear. You know, a lot of good stuff is going to happen, obviously. And you know, like less people get sick and die, which is, you know, arguably a good. But yeah, there's going to be all this stuff too. So well, anyway,
I'm going to say just that it is all related to an American hyper capitalist, hyper workaholic culture that this sort of pandemic gave us somehow a little bit of a break from in certain ways. Obviously, it was really hard for work in other ways. But now as we re-enter, we're like, oh, it's not about just striving and making more and more and more money. It's about quality of life. And we have to be fighting for those things like healthcare, like a safe and, you know, safe environment free from guns, like, you know, a safe environment that isn't on fire all the time and safe drinking water. Like these are the things that matter. A space that you can live in. You're not in a like a, you know, living in a one room apartment with your entire family and dogs. That it's put a lot of things into perspective. And so I think you're speaking to that, like we don't want to lose that perspective about what really matters.
Yeah, and I hope that we won't, or that if we do, we won't lose much of it. But we'll have to see, you know, 5 years from now, we'll look back. What will we be thinking and saying about the pandemic? What will have lingered? Can't wait to find out about that. Top 10 things that lingered coming in 10 years. Anyway, thank you as always, Francesca, for joining us. Loved your list. Do feel like I learned something about you.
Likewise.
And thank you everyone for being members, for making this possible. We really do appreciate your support, especially considering what's going on YouTube lately. So thank you so much for that. Hope that you enjoy the back catalog, and please post below if you have ideas for top 10 lists. Not only would we like the idea, but we want to credit you in the video, which we've done before. So until next time, thank you. As he had promised during the campaign, President Joe Biden brought the United States back into the Paris Climate Agreement. But what does it actually mean? What should we be looking for in the future if we want to see the US be part of this international effort to deal with climate change? Well, joining us right now is an expert who's going to spell it all out for us. This is the Director of Strategy and Policy for the COP High Level Champions for Climate Action, Jen Austin. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
We're very glad to have you here. So I'm assuming you were not particularly surprised by the reentry. It had been telegraphed pretty much as anything else politically over the past year or so.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very clear commitment by the Biden campaign. And so I think we knew by day one that that was going to be a priority for day one. And they did, in fact, follow through on their first day with an executive order, including a commitment to rejoin the Paris Agreement.
Awesome. And for those who might not know all the ins and outs, especially with the US's checkered history over the past few years with the agreement, in sort of broad terms, what is the agreement about? What is it intended to accomplish?
Sure. So the Paris Agreement is a global agreement through which the countries of the world are getting together to try to address climate change, their biggest shared pressing challenge and concern. And it was negotiated over many years up until and came together in 2015. So the Paris Agreement was agreed that year. And importantly, they had learned from many years of negotiations on climate. And what the Paris Agreement did is it made sure that every country had a specific emissions reduction commitment. And in previous times, in previous attempts at climate agreements, either not all the countries were included, or they tried too much to negotiate the different exactly what those targets needed to be. And so countries ultimately couldn't sign up to it. And what the Paris Agreement did was it sort of merged both of those. It made sure that every country in the world, including some of the fast developing countries, were involved. Whereas when we started these negotiations, now 26 years ago, because we're coming up on the 26th conference, there was a very different balance in size of economies and who was responsible for emissions. And so some of the developing countries like India and China were not included in needing to have their own emissions reduction targets. By the time we got to 2015, obviously, given the size of those economies and the size of their emissions, it was important that they had commitments of some sort. Equally though, we live in a world in which countries are sovereign nations. They make their own rules. Most laws are enforceable within country boundaries and less so across country boundaries. And so the agreement made it so that every country was committed to putting forward a commitment, and there's a process for transparency, and that those commitments would be transparent and transparently reported on. And then we'd allow the political process to play out through which countries make progress towards those commitments, can put pressure and encouragement on each other to achieve what they said they would achieve and then go further. And now, 5 years later, we're set up for what were called the first review and ratchet. And so the deal itself included a plan for targets that cover 5 years, and then every 5 years to together revisit those targets, recognizing that as big a breakthrough as it was for all the countries to agree to the Paris Agreement when they did, the goals they put on the table didn't add up to where we needed to be. So we knew already that we would need to revisit that. And that's really what's on the table for this year.
So basically you're saying that even if during this review it's shown that they've accomplished what they had individually said they would after 5 years, that by itself isn't necessarily an amazing sign in terms of being able to meet the overall goals over a longer period of time?
Right. It's very good progress, but it's not enough. And so the Paris Agreement included the countries of the world together saying that they wanted to limit warming to no more than 2 degrees, with best efforts to actually limit that to 1.5 degrees. That was their shared goal. Then they had to put an individual commitment on the table. Even on day one, if you added up those individual commitments, they didn't add to 2 degrees, never mind 1.5. Since then, the science has only gotten more clear. We know the urgency has only gotten more. The difference between that 1.5 and 2 degrees in terms of impacts in the world is very, very stark. And so if we were on track to achieve even those original commitments, that was a first, very important step, but only a first step. The reality is, in some cases, we're not on track to achieve those commitments. And now that next step has to be taken, both to figure out what needs to be done to make sure those goals are achieved, and importantly, what that next level of ambition needs to be to make sure we get to our shared ultimate goal of limiting warming to 1.5.
Okay, and so re-entering in real terms, what does that mean for the United States? What does it mean, you know, for Biden, for the federal government, for individuals who might be watching this? Because from what you're saying, there are these goals you're supposed to get to, but it doesn't necessarily mandate here are particular things that you need to do, here are things that you can't do. So is it, it's pretty free form. In what particular way is it binding on either, you know, the Senate or for Biden in particular?
Yeah. Well, most importantly, it shows a clear recommitment to climate change for this administration across the board, which they have talked about in the campaign and have certainly really focused on consistently throughout their earliest days in office. But the Paris Agreement is the way in which countries have agreed that they're going to address this shared problem. And it is such a shared problem that everybody needs to be a part of, but nobody can achieve alone, that it really is important that the countries of the world have a shared sense of where they're going. They're at least on the same page about what that goal is and that everybody has a role to play. And so as an international matter, it's important for the rest of the world to see loud and clear and be able to believe and trust that the US is back at the table and that the US is committed to this. As a domestic matter, it also means that the US is working on then figuring out what that next target will be. And so there was a target put on the table in 2015 when the last administration pulled out of the Paris Agreement, and it was signaling essentially that they were no longer committed to achieving that target. And so the world needs to know what is it that the US is committed to doing. It's a huge economy, a big emitter. It needs to do its part across the board in terms of helping tackle climate change. That starts with domestic actions and how they play on the global stage. Not only the UN negotiations on climate, but every other time that world leaders get together talking about anything these days, climate is a part of that discussion and the US is an influential voice. So them being there in a positive, constructive and aligned manner is important. And then at home working on that new target, which they are doing, working very hard on right now, and which they have committed to releasing by Earth Day, which is April 22nd. So a little under a month from now, President Biden is hosting a head of state level summit for, I think, about 40 countries. They just sent the invites out yesterday to a what they're calling a leader level summit on climate change, specifically to address climate. That's on Earth Day, April 22nd, and they've subsequently committed to having their own target on the table by then. So right now, you know that across every corner of the government, agencies, cabinet secretaries, their staff are looking at, they're crunching the numbers on what is it that we can do on climate. In particular, they're looking at that through the lens of what is it that we can and need to do to help this economy recover from COVID. Fortunately, more and more climate solutions are positioned to be effective drivers of growth and economic recovery and job creation. And so those are questions that they're going to be able to look at hand in hand and find quite a few measures that are both beneficial to society, to health, to job creation, the economy, and to our shared global problem of climate. And so the government has talked about taking a whole of government approach to climate change. President Biden has talked about his agenda to build back better. And those two come together with climate action as a real pillar of how we build back this economy. So they're crunching those numbers now. Everybody's watching to see what that number is that comes out on or before April 22nd. And that will be significant in terms of certainly the action it sets in motion in terms of domestic policy and processes, and also the signal that it sends to the world as to just how ambitious they're ready to be.
And just a quick reminder to the audience, in the run up to that basically sort of deadline for Earth Day, we're doing quite a bit of coverage on the environment and climate and all of that. We'll also be doing a special on Earth Day. We're going to be bringing in environmental activists and that sort of thing. So definitely look forward to that. Well, Jen, one last question I want to ask you though, has to do, I guess, with the ratcheting process that you were talking about. So along the way, we have to see our countries doing what they need to do. So let's say in theory, it shows that some are not. What are the tools that can be used to influence that, either carrots or sticks, that would not lead to a state deciding, you know what, it's not worth it. If I leave, I can do whatever I want. And if one state backs out, maybe others do. Is that a concern? And what are the tools to try to influence them without producing that outcome?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the interesting things we've seen is how the Paris Agreement and the process for the ratchet actually held firm and kept itself together and kept moving forward, even when the US government commitment was wavering. And so, you know, the biggest economy and amongst the biggest economies and emitters in the world was wavering from that over the last 4 years. We actually saw the rest of the countries of the world not abandoning the agreement. No one else left the Paris Agreement in that time period. In addition, what we saw was an outpouring of leadership and commitment and sort of pro-climate action push from not only some of the other countries in the world, but a lot of the other influential entities out there. And so, you know, my current work is with what we call the non-state actors. And so only national governments can be actual signatories and parties to the Paris Agreement. But obviously, climate action and policy impacts everyone. And so businesses, investors, cities, states, civil society, universities, groups from across society and the economy have come out over the last 5 years since Paris. There were a number of them advocating for a strong Paris Agreement, but since then that has only grown in terms of the demand for action, those committing themselves to specific action. And so there's a strong base of commitment to climate action amongst other actors who are also influential politically. And so that's a part of the answer, is that there's a real momentum here that you're seeing in terms of the non-governmental or non-national government actors, which is helpful. Essentially, it boils down to the economics. You know, it's such a shared concern, and actually the economic opportunity of, well, the impacts of not acting on climate and the opportunity to potentially establish oneself, whether you're a business, investor, or country, or city or state jurisdiction, as a leader in the low and zero carbon economy that we know we're turning towards, is now starting to tip the scales such that the dynamic of that conversation is quite different than it was even 5 years ago, and certainly sort of 7, 8, 10 years ago, when it felt more about of sort of who had an obligation to carry what burden. And certainly there's, you know, that's a perspective that's important. But in fact, the way most people are evaluating the opportunity now to take action or not take action is about risk that they need to mitigate, impacts that they're feeling, and ways in which they see a competitive advantage to getting ahead of the curve on climate action, as opposed to being left behind by trends that are really growing quite quickly in terms of the advantages of acting on climate.
And what you'd referred to earlier, some of the economic benefits in terms of growth that could be achieved.
Yeah.
Jen Austin is the Director of Strategy and Policy at the COP High Level Champions for Climate Action. Jen, really want to thank you for taking time out to help catch me and our audience up to speed on all this. Really do appreciate
it. Thanks so much for having me. Pleasure, and I'll tune in for the Earth Day version as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.